So if I help you get one property this year, that's going to make you $35,000 in profits over the next 10 years.
Have you ever wondered the unseen challenges vacation rental managers face? Welcome to Top 10 Mistakes. I'm Brooke Fouts, and I'm on a mission to interview vacation rental managers across the country to uncover the biggest mistakes and golden lessons that have shaped their careers. Each episode delivers real, unfiltered stories of mistakes and triumphs, giving you the insights and strategies to avoid common pitfalls and to accelerate your success in the competitive world of vacation rentals. So buckle up and get ready to dive into today's story of challenge, triumph, and transformation.
All right. Hey there, Brooke. How's it going today?
Conrad, what is going on, my friend? Did you hear? Did I tell you I just got a pay raise?
No. How'd you do that? What happened?
My oldest daughter just graduated college. So I'm done. 15 years of private school and I am finished. So I went out and bought my wife a car. So.
Oh, dang. Yeah. Well, that's going to be with you for the rest of your life. The wife, at least the car, those don't last quite as long, but no, that's awesome. Well, congratulations. That sounds very exciting for her, obviously. And yeah, now she gets to go into the next chapter. That is awesome.
I know. Congratulations. She's got a job at Amazon already. So she's really stoked. Very proud. Nice.
Awesome. Can she throw me any discount codes, promo codes, anything like that? Or do I just have to keep paying full price at Amazon?
Damn, I didn't even think about that. I haven't even asked her that yet. Maybe that's a question I need to ask her tonight at dinner.
All right. Well, if she can count my Prime subscription, I would appreciate it. You know, I'm shelling out all this money every year. But no, it's all good. We've got a very Prime knowledgeable guest with us today. So I'm excited, David, to have you with us. So thank you for joining us. David, maybe if you don't mind, for some folks that maybe haven't heard of you or don't know your background, could you give us a little background into the company or into your company that you're with today, how you got started in the vacation rental industry and where you focus on today?
Yeah, I'll just give a super high overview of the arc into the where we are now. So basically what happened was I exit a business and we buy these properties out in the Smoky Mountains and we're loving life. We go out, we stay at our vacation rental. We want to monetize it. So we stick it with a property manager and same story of so many in the industry. We try a few property managers. We aren't happy. And so then we go ahead and decide to start self-managing. From there, it grows into a property management company. Along the way, we build this really good book direct brand called SmokyMountains.com and just huge proponents of that whole book direct movement. And so then fast forward a couple of years, we have about 150 or so properties. Steve Milo and V-Trips come along and they buy the owner contracts, but we kept the technology we had developed. And so we kept SmokyMountains.com. We then turned it into an OTA. Once that worked well, we also launched HawaiianIslands.com and FloridaPanhandle.com. Along the way, with all this going on, we also developed out a purpose-built neighborhood in the Gatlinburg area. And then ultimately, these brands that I built, the different OTA brands, sold those to Guesty, the parent company of Stay Sense Now. So that's now who I work for. So today, I'm now in the chief evangelist role at Guesty. And which means if you look at the whole background, it's one of the more holistic backgrounds in the space where I've been an RBO. I've also been a property manager. I've been a customer of property management companies. I've integrated as a client with PMSs. Now I work on the opposite side of the table, actually being a PMS. And I've also done the real estate side. So it's a lot of different pieces and then the OTA side on both sides of the table. So a lot of times in the career, I've been on both sides of the table. I think that's one of the more unique things about my background, if you will.
You've seen it from every direction.
There's always a new direction, though, it seems. But someday I'm gonna feel just like, all right, I've got it all down.
Yeah. Never. And I owe you thanks for many things, David, but one is that actually you were the one that connected me and Brooke. Sometimes we ask people when we start the show, how did you meet Brooke originally, which I don't know, but I think I owe you, David, a thank you for you connecting me with Brooke originally. But I'm curious, how did you and Brooke originally meet, you and David and Brooke meeting?
Yeah, so we met, I think the original time was at a LiveRes conference back when Brooke was working there, and I think I was keynoting the conference, maybe out in Austin, or was it out in Arizona?
I can't even remember, but yeah,
it was one of those.
It was, yeah.
And so we met CJ, actually. CJ Stan was like, hey, Dave, he's always high energy. So you got to meet this guy. You're going to love him. And I did, of course. And the rest is kind of history. And Brooke and I have been close friends ever since.
That's right. It's amazing, Conrad, how many people on this podcast have come from when we ask them the intro. It was LiveRes, you know, so I was only there a short period of time. I was only there 2 years, but I met so many people heading up sales and marketing there, and also headed up the mastermind community, or the advisory boards, which we turned into masterminds. So it's funny how that spawns so many friendships.
Yeah, it's like a diaspora. It starts one way and then it has these like long lasting effects for sure. David, in the interest of time, maybe we'll dive into the mistakes and go through some of the things that you shared in the book, Vacation Rental Secrets, and we'll go in order. You went 10 to 1. I'll go 1 to 10 and rename things, but we'll try to keep things on track and see what kind of damage we can do here. So if you don't mind, we're going to dive right in. The first one that I have listed here, my prevailing attitude was naive optimism. Damon John popularized the idea of the power of broke, which is closely related and can be a positive. However, the naive optimism was more closely related to the Dunning-Kruger effect. You might need to explain that. I overestimated my own abilities and knowledge of the vacational management space without thoroughly understanding everything. So you go through some more detail here in the book, but could you explain this to us? What was this naive optimism that you had? What's the Dunning-Kruger effect? And what did you learn from that as you built the business?
Yeah, I'll start with Dunning-Kruger, actually. It's a fascinating psychology study that these two guys, Dunning and Kruger, did. And to put it in just really simple terms, it's the idea that the less you know about something, oftentimes, the more you think you know about something. It's why my 10-year-old son will yell at a professional football coach for making the wrong call. He doesn't even know what all the positions are titled. It's why all these different things happen on a regular basis. And we think we understand better than a general the strategy of war, and because we read 3 news articles. But then as you progress and you get more knowledgeable on a topic, so now my son is older and he's more knowledgeable. He knows that he doesn't know as much about football. And so he's slower to criticize a call because he's watched the different calls work and not work. He understands the plays a little bit better. Or somebody that understands war, like a colonel, is probably going to be slower to criticize the general because they know way more and realize in knowing way more that they know less than they used to think they knew is a good way to think of it. So that's what happened in vacation rentals. That's what I mean by naive optimism. I came at it without understanding there were like hundreds and hundreds of moving pieces to this incredibly complex idea of competing customer sets. And you have to have the demand and you have to have the supply and all of this stuff. And we're trying to make this business work. And I looked at it like, oh, I'm way better at internet marketing than this company that manages my property. So I'm just going to kill it and get in there and do it right without even understanding I needed permits and tax licenses and all these other things that I was really bad at. And so you fast forward just a little bit of time, all of a sudden I realize I don't know as much as I thought I did. That naive optimism didn't serve me well in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think this is something that we all go through, whether it's personally or professionally, this idea of when you get there initially. Brooke, and this may be the case for a little bit of the things we talked about today with David, I don't think that one was mentioned specifically, and yet I think his observation is spot on that a lot of us deal with that same problem for sure.
100%. Yeah, I think this is the first time this has come up, but yeah, I think there's a lot of people that, how hard can this be? I own this property and I have this management company. They're awful. Like, this cannot be that hard. This cannot be that difficult. And they jump into it. I've seen it time and time again. And I think we all realize it is a hell of a lot harder than you think.
Yeah. And it's all these like discrete things. I think maybe you go through that piece, David, right? It's like, you obviously are unbelievably knowledgeable on the marketing side, but a lot of what you did wasn't marketing, right? To make the company successful, the operational side, that's a heavy load. I think I recall you telling me in the past about, you know, a TV would crack and you guys would go to Best Buy immediately and go replace the TV. Maybe you could talk about the operational side of the business and what you learned during your time as the property manager way back when.
Yeah, I learned it's really hard. And this actually is a good segue into the next lesson that I learned the hard way, or mistake. But just that idea of you're always on, people are very demanding. It's not just this easy thing where you set up a listing and you hit publish and you're done. And the money flows in. It does not work that way. It's you are going to earn every dollar. You're either going to earn that through rock solid processes and a good staff, or through hell. You're going to go into hell. And that's what we did for a good period of time until we figured out our processes and until we got a staff. And so some of those other points will come up here later, I have a feeling.
I've always had the opinion, I don't know if you feel this way too, David, when you were doing it, that the moment that you take the photos and write the property description and get the rates set and click publish is actually when the work starts. Some people might think that's when the work is, oh yeah, we've made some progress. It's no, you're basically at the starting line right now, not the finish line of the actual business.
Yeah. Exactly.
Awesome. Let's go into the next one then, because like you said, you alluded to it a second ago. The next mistake here, I assumed everyone was like me. As I created processes and tried to understand the mindset of our guests, I made an assumption that the general public was like me. I assumed they would figure out how to switch the input on a TV. I assumed they would read the guidebook. I assumed they would type in the Wi-Fi password correctly, and so on and so forth. The truth is that wasn't the case, and you perhaps incorrectly designed your business model and then had to change things later on. So what was this? When did you realize this, and how did you change things or modify things as you went along?
I realized that before we hosted our very first guest. And so it was this idea, man, we weren't even living out there in the market yet. We were at Toys R Us. So this is how long ago it was. And we're shopping and I get a phone call from a guest and they're like, hey, we need to cancel for 8 days from now. And it was non-refundable at this point. And I explained very calmly, hey, it's non-refundable. What are you needing to cancel for? Of course, we all have to learn to defend our cancellation policies and when to flex on them and things like that over time. I didn't know any of that at this point. And the ladies, it's really forecasting some cold weather then. And those roads might ice up. And it just blew my mind because we weren't even at the event yet. It hadn't occurred. It wasn't even calling for snow or ice. It was calling for cold weather in a month that it's always cold, January. And now she's wanting to be able to cancel because it's going to be cold in January. And it just felt so illogical and unreasonable to me. And this would happen over and over again. Somebody needs a hairdryer 1 a.m. And in the early days, we'd run it to them, because we felt bad that there wasn't a hairdryer in the unit if the individual needed a hairdryer. We didn't really look at, did we say it had one or not? It probably didn't on the listing because we didn't check the hairdryer amenity normally. But this individual wanted a hairdryer right then and we took it to them. Another thing would be the input on the TV. I'll never forget the time when I was talking to a gentleman and trying to help him troubleshoot. He was very angry that it wasn't working. And I told him, sir, it actually is working. There's a button named input. If you'll click that one time, it's going to switch to the DVD player. He's wanting to use a DVD or the Blu-ray player. And I didn't come on vacation. You can see somebody out here. And so these are the types of things I would have never made these calls to start with. I would have figured out how to get there if there was a snowstorm, or realized I'd signed a contract and been like, oh, I should have bought travel insurance. I wouldn't ever ask for something like a hairdryer that's not critical in the middle of the night. There could be something pretty bad wrong with the property. And if it's not getting further damage, I'm going to wait till 10 the next morning or 9 the next morning to tell the host or property management company. And we'd stayed at so many rentals, we just assumed everybody was like us. I don't think we had ever called out maintenance or called in with a problem other than just trying to access a unit or something like that and get our code. But that's not how the general public is. And it only takes a small sliver of the general public to not be that way, to flip this whole thing on its end, your model for how many times you're going to send out a maintenance person when that's included free of charge in your contract to the owners. So there were things like that that were just a little bit off that really, until we figured them out, sucked.
I think a lot of it comes down to just the law of averages. And if you think of, I remember we were doing 3,500 or 5,000 reservations or whatever the number was per season. It just takes a very small sliver, right? A 1%, 2% where it actually becomes pretty significant, where you're like, I can't believe these other people are like this. I think there was a very famous transcript of a call. Who knows? It could be urban legend, but I read it one time with Dell tech support. And if you read this, the guy was going around and they couldn't get his computer to work. And the support guy goes, all right, now go in the back of the computer and make sure the power button was flipped on. He goes, well, I can't see it. The power's out. That's why, of course, the computer wasn't working. No. The power was out.
Oh, no.
I feel like there's a quote about this, isn't there? Isn't there some quote to the effect of, think of the average person you meet and then realize roughly half the people out there are stupider than that person. It's like you're going to naturally run into that bottom curve of people over time.
That is so scary. I didn't even need to hear that.
But it's one of those things.
What do you call doctor who graduates last in his class or in their class?
Doctor. Yeah. And they're the top 10%, right? Yeah. Imagine the bottom 10%. And ultimately, at some point, they're going to book your property, right? And your point, David, it's like, you have to be, and this was a theme at the Dharm conference that we were all just at shortly a few weeks back now at this point, which is that you want to be hospitable to them. And it sounds like some of your stories were that, David, where you tried to go above and beyond and deliver. And I'm sure that did bring you some goodwill and some happy guests, but it also probably seemed like it brought a lot of stress and a lot of pain as well, unfortunately.
Yeah. And there was also the balancing guest needs, because at that point we were a very small staff. And so if I took a hairdryer to somebody at 1 a.m, And that property was 45 minutes away from my house. And I could have just put that with our maintenance person or a cleaner the next day and got it to him at 9 a.m. Now I'm shot for the next day because I've been up half the night getting a hairdryer to somebody. And next day, I'm not delivering great customer service, great owner service. And so we had to realize there's that balancing between the urgence, you know, those urgent things that arise versus the hey, well, the business has to go forward. And so we had to figure that out. And that was very challenging at first.
Was this a big mind shift for you, David, going from, obviously you've been in technology your entire life, and then going from technology to really hospitality, was where you everything could be done previously through tech support and through whatever you're doing through your website? Was it a big shift coming to here where it's now completely not all technology?
It was a shift on the technology side. Honestly, the bigger shift was the one I was just describing on the customer service side, because having flown private jets for a company called NetJets, I had this ultra white glove approach to how we did this. And I didn't care if you paid $89 for a condo for one night, or if you were in our most expensive lodge, I wanted to wow you. I wanted to give you an experience that would just be an unmatched vacation experience for you and your family. And the idea was treat each guest like they are the only guest, treat each owner like they are the only owner. But in doing that, it was coming at a high cost. And we realized actually that there was a prioritization where we could only do one or the other of those. And so we began to treat every owner like they were the only owner. We stayed true to that founding principle, but we lost the treat every guest like they are the only guest, because we realized there were interdependencies, because we had so many of those that would impact other guests downstream if we didn't balance the needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's go in the next kind of one here. And ultimately, this is obviously a tragic thing that happened, but we'll try to talk about it a little bit and your plan, what ended up transpiring here. So the next mistake: I did not have a proper disaster mitigation plan in place. In 2016, there were significant wildfires in Gatlinburg and the surrounding cities. At the end of the day, everyone had to evacuate. The threat was severe and pretty serious. And you had, I think you say here in the book, 22 properties that you were managing that were destroyed or were unable to be used going forward. So what was your learning from this process? Obviously, it was terrible. And I think a lot of properties were damaged, but what was the disaster mitigation plan that you wish you had in place if that were to happen down the road again?
Yeah, we had planned for a fire in one neighborhood. And we felt like that was a worst case scenario, highly unlikely to ever happen, that we would have good information about this starting if it were to happen, because it'd be so dramatic and the emergency services would let us know and the different things would happen. What we didn't count on was what happened, where there was this fire up in the mountains, 100+ mile per hour winds that distributed the embers all over the counties. And we didn't know where there were fires. We didn't know which roads were open. And at first, we started to see a fire over here and then a fire over there in Gatlinburg. And we thought they were just in Gatlinburg. As the night went on, we realized it was all over the county. We didn't know where they were or where it was spreading to next. And we evacuated every property. A better plan ahead of time would have been to, like, hey, if there's something that's endangering guests that could endanger more guests, we get every guest out. And period. End of story. We don't play around with this. Not that we were playing around, but we were just chasing our tail somewhat, trying to get people out over here and then over here. And we didn't know where the fire was. So we were really just thinking it was in Gatlinburg. But there should have been some alarm bells going off in our head. We should have had a plan. If something starts happening and we don't know where this is at, we get everybody out. And I think that, there could be lessons even for, say, like a hurricane market of not waiting too late. And that would be like a lesson I would take to a hurricane market of, it's hard to balance that emergency versus revenue equation. And I get that. But if the worst thing you can do for your revenue today, tomorrow, and forever is have a bunch of people get hurt or die in a property. And so you have to have that at the very top of that hierarchy on how you make the decision.
Yeah. Here's another one. I don't think we saw this either right in the book, but I would probably argue that the majority of most management companies don't have a disaster plan in place. But you said it right, David. There are probably a bunch in like the hurricane, the Outer Banks. They get hit all the time, and I'm sure they're used to it. They've got their playbook they follow. But I don't think a lot of companies have this, and it's something they should have in place. We didn't have a lot of hurricanes that hit us in Ocean City. But we did have a couple pretty bad storms, and we definitely didn't have any kind of playbook in place. So exactly what you just said, we were scrambling like mad. Like I was like deer in headlights, didn't know what to do, but we pulled it together and ended up scrambling, and we could have been a lot more efficient from it. And we ended up wasting a lot of time, money, and effort by doing it that way. And we didn't do our owners right by doing it that way or our guests. So I highly recommend, if you don't have a disaster plan in place, do it. I'm sure there's some stuff, some resources on VRMA. I'm sure you probably even ask ChatGPT to help you out on that too, but or consult with other people in the industry and see what they've done. Especially there's companies that have, you know, faced wildfires, and there's companies that have faced a lot of hurricanes. It'd probably be a good place to start.
Yeah, and this is one of those few areas that I've found your competitors are really willing to work with you and share information too, is what I would throw out there. So don't be afraid, even if you may not share a lot of information with your competition. This is one thing that everybody can typically get behind. Okay, let's all get together for coffee and discuss how we could serve the destination in a disaster plan that works for everybody.
Great idea. And that was a big theme in the book, was not reaching out to your competitors earlier and just forming that bond and to help each other out.
The agency that I worked for, I think the purpose of the system was actually to tell all the guests on Wednesday to take their trash cans out to the curb. And that was quickly repurposed when a hurricane hit this North Carolina Topsail area for Mike Harrington, if memory serves correctly. Instead of a trash notification system, it was a please get out of the property because there's a hurricane heading your way notification system. But even though it wasn't originally what it was intended for, it worked well. And they were also able to call some guests and get people out of there. And ultimately, I think it was an okay ending. Obviously, properties were damaged, but people were not hurt, which is ultimately, I feel like, the least that you can try to accomplish in that type of scenario for sure. You mentioned a second ago, David, befriending competition, or not even in your mistake, you mentioned the term befriending competition or just reaching out to competition. And as Brooke mentioned, this is one that people said over and over again. So your mistake, as I read it here, instead of fearing local competition, I wish I'd made the effort to grab lunch or grab drinks. Meetings could have been helpful to discuss opportunities, technologies, city regulations, advocacy, and so on. Eventually you did become friends with them. And now it's funny because some of those former competitors are now customers of yours on smokingmountains.com and list their property. So what was maybe the first breakthrough with reaching out to competition, and how did it later turn into a good business relationship on both sides?
Yeah. So probably the first one was actually somebody that managed my property back with iTrip before I started RBOing it. And after he found out I was in property management, he just reached out and we had a common vendor. Through the common vendor, it's, hey, let's the three of us go out to lunch. And it caught me off guard because here's this guy that I yanked my property from them to self-manage it. Now here I am out to lunch with him. And he was just taking a mentoring approach almost to it. Hey, you look like you're burned out, man. What's going on? And this is tough work. I get it. But here, let's talk through some tips to deal with this. And I remember one of the things he said, which ties into the whole customer service thing that we were talking about earlier. So the gentleman's name is Dennis with iTrip, and he's still the franchisee out there. He said, it's easy to get jaded with guests because you only talk to the people that want to complain or having a bad time on vacation. He goes, it looks like that's just wearing you down. He goes, have you ever thought about just buying cupcakes or donuts and stopping by a bunch of your properties just with that and saying hi to the guests and seeing how much fun people are having on vacation? Because this is something I do when this starts to just really grate on me. And I did that. He had other tips for me as well. And this wasn't just too long before I sold the property management division off. And so I can't say I went in and then made six more great relationships at that point. And then obviously relationships were required then to launch the OTA. But when I think back to it, I sold myself short by not getting to be great friends with some of these same people now that are great friendships. Somebody like Sean from Aunt Bugs, that last week we were hanging out together at a bar here in Nashville and doing things together. And those relationships now, these are fun people that I like hanging out. We have so many shared like background type stories, but yet we're all diverse. And I missed out on that during a season where they could have probably benefited from me at times. I could have definitely benefited from them. And we're all selling ourselves short on that, in my opinion.
Yeah. I made this one myself, and I think this was probably one of the most popular mistakes out there. And it's one of the things I learned. So after I sold Vantage, and I didn't do it, when I went down to work for Trover down in Orlando, he did that all the time. He definitely reached out. At one point, like, I felt like once a month, there was about a dozen of his competitors would come into our conference room and they would just to get together. It was like the mafia heads at the lunch meeting or dinner meeting, and it was great. But I was like, what are you doing? And he's, I've learned so much from them, and we've shared a lot of our success. And he's, there is so much business to go around, and every time I've done it, it's helped. And one of the things I've done here at Vintory even is every time I see a competitor come up in our neck of the woods with helping these professional property managers grow their inventory, I reach out to them, and it's worked out really well. JJ King started a competing company. He ended up now working for me. Wes Walker ended up launching PropSum. Now he's working for Vintory as well. So it's actually ended up helping me out immensely by doing that. But how if I would have been afraid of them, or I would have looked at them as like the enemy, I wouldn't have two of my greatest employees on the team right now. Steve Schwab, I think, said this perfectly in the book. He said, today's competitor is key to your growth tomorrow.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I like that framing of it. And yeah, it's, once you do it once, you're just like, oh, this isn't so bad. You know what I mean? Like, no one came up behind me and smacked me in the side of the head and hurt me. It was like, at worst case scenario, you may say, I'm not comfortable sharing that. I've said that a few times when I've talked to so-called competitors, and everyone's just like, oh, okay, no problem. If you don't want to share, that's fine. And then they can help you in other ways. So I'm a big believer in that as well, obviously. Awesome. Number six, I didn't know my customer acquisition cost, or CAC, by channel soon enough. Some of Brooke's favorite letters, CAC. So I know where he has a lot to add on this. Huge fan of throwing spaghetti and seeing what sticks. You also must know your CAC, your customer acquisition cost. Early on, you make decisions on gut or emotions, and it wasn't always correct. So understanding how much it costs to get a booking from your website, how much it costs to get a booking from Airbnb, from Vrbo, and so on and so forth, led to a healthier, more stable business. Was there a light switch moment, David, or was it just more of a slow burn of, I need to figure this out, and figuring it out by channel? How'd you eventually learn what your true CAC was per channel?
Yeah, so we needed to know this all along, and I knew that, but we were, again, going so many different directions that we just got lazy at the beginning. And at the beginning, we threw a bunch of spaghetti at the wall, as I like to say. By about the time, a lot of these were listings on annual agreements. By the time it came full year and back around, that's when I really dialed in on this. And I said, okay, we're going to go channel by channel. We're going to see how much it costs to get a booking. Now on our website, how much do we spend on hosting? How much do we spend on content? How much did we spend on paid? All of those different things. We looked at our own direct booking cost, which obviously also includes things like your reservationists and other things. That there's all these hidden costs in that. And then over here, I'm looking at the OTAs, and the OTAs can also have hidden costs. So you're looking at that. And then there were different subscription levels at this point, and sites like Dwellable that ended up getting bought later on, or some of these different ones. And so we basically had spreadsheets where we would track all this and then see what was working and what wasn't. What's interesting is this has never been easier to do than it is right now. This information is so readily available now versus in the not too distant past. And I was just leading a demand summit with Matt Landau this past summer in Waco. And when I asked the room, I said, does anybody know their exact customer acquisition cost by any of their channels? Not a single person in the room knew it. And this was an advanced audience. And so it shows me that I'm not the only one that made this mistake. But if you don't know this, you're flying blind. It is a mistake. You should know customer acquisition cost, should know it by all the channels. And then you should also just really be dialing that in more and more over time.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that about it, because I was just going to say, I don't think there's too many companies out there that actually know what their CAC is. It's ironic here. We have, especially at an advanced class like that. But one thing I think Dennis over Cassiola that kind of blew me away was he realized that he couldn't compete with the OTAs, and he tried and tried, and he finally realized, he's like, you know what? It's actually cheaper for me to actually just get it. I know this is going to be controversial, but it's easier for me to just actually use the OTAs. Because trying to compete and get these direct bookings is actually costing me much more when it's all said and done. But at least he did that analysis, and he knew what his CAC was to be able to do it. David, I'm curious, speaking of CAC, but on the other side of it, did you ever go through the analysis of your CAC from inventory and supply?
Yeah, that one was so easy because it costs so little to acquire property management customers. We could send a postcard push to the market, and normally if we had a compelling offer, sign a property almost every time, and then we'd look at the lifetime value or what that home was going to be worth to the program over the long haul. It was just easy. Same for the paid terms, and I've seen this even recently in our market. Not much competition on a lot of the paid terms at different points. It fluctuates up and down, but I had that set to something ridiculously high, like $100 per click, because I figured if I could get 10 people on the website, that I could probably get one of those to be a customer. And that's, I'll do that deal all day long at $1,000. And so we had a pretty refined process for that time on being able to schedule an appointment and a good funnel that would push people through that with some compelling offers along the way. And so we had a very good conversion rate, and we just bid to the moon, but really only ended up paying $5 or $10 a click. It wasn't much.
Yeah. I think the key part there is you're following kind of the 7 key messaging building blocks, right? You're using compelling offers, using risk reversals, but also knowing you were probably really responsive. You'd respond quickly. And we know, again, when we've done studies on this, most people just aren't responding. So if you're responding quickly and you have a good compelling offer and a good program, I actually learned from you the risk reversals. You had your 100% satisfaction guaranteed, which is a fantastic risk reversal, which helped on that closing process.
Yeah, you absolutely have to answer the phone or the email as soon as it comes in. You are making a mistake if you don't. So when we were small, we realized that wasn't doable for us. We found a company called Ruby Receptionist, I think was their name, that did a fantastic job answering. It wasn't a cheap service. It was a couple dollars a call, $5 a call maybe. But they would actually do a warm transfer over to us if we were out of the field, out taking care of a property, doing what property managers do. And then it made us look a lot bigger than we were, because it's, oh, he is in his office. We'll transfer you now. And my office happened to be a bathroom that I'm plunging a toilet or whatever. But they make you look professional. And most importantly, even if they couldn't reach us, they capture that lead information right then. And then we had a similar product to Calendly that they could schedule through as well right there.
Nice. Love it.
Yeah. To your first point though, David, I feel like it's common when I'm on a first call with someone on the marketing services side that they'll ask me what an acceptable return on ad spend goes. And I go, I have no idea. What's your margins? What's your cost? What's your commission, right? And usually I give a stock answer, but it does surprise me how often I would feel like you would have that a little more dialed in on the property manager side. At least a quick answer of like, all right, if we're going to spend $1,000 on ads, I expect X back in terms of gross revenue, or I expect X number of bookings back at roughly X value. And it's pretty common that people stumble on that. So I wish I could do a better job too on my side of educating people a little bit, because then I can just get better answers too on the marketing side as far as how much you might want to spend, what's your average conversion rate is and stuff like that. Obviously, I think there's a skill to managing the ads, but some of it's just math. Some of it's just how much can I spend? What can I get back out of it? So yeah, I couldn't agree more on that piece. Yeah. Awesome. Number 5 then here, right in the middle. I waited too long to make friends with small property managers and single property run by owners. Early on, I thought I was in a different league than the individual that owned one property. Eventually, I got wiser. There's bright minds in our industry, and some great ideas come from small property managers and RBOs. The combination of going to Heather Bayer's Vacation Rental Success Summit and Matt Landau's Inner Circle, which also has a lot of single property hosts, and blog corrected the miscalculation. And eventually you learn to talk with these people. So what was first? I'm curious. Was it Heather? Was it Matt? Was it Mr. Landau? What was the first one that got you into that? And what are some maybe notable like single property or a few property managers that you've dealt with in the past that you've learned something from, maybe if you're able to share?
Yeah. So it was actually Matt Landau that I met first. And then he introduced me to Heather not too long after that. And a lot of these owners were people in that inner circle, we call it 5 properties or less. People like Rick Oster, that, you know, former executive at a television channel, semi-retired, managing some properties. And in the early days, it would have been like, oh, they just have a couple properties. I'm not going to listen to what they have to say. But then you take somebody like Rick, and he was one of the first ones. He started to talk to me about how he was doing this niche marketing around golf and building these golf houses that were purpose-built. And this was a long time ago. This was like in 2014, down on the Robert Trent Jones golf trail. And the houses were so good. He had the actual resort referring him business. And then he's had other ideas around ADA accessible properties that are truly accessible, instead of just saying, it's pretty accessible. There's 2 steps. It's like an actual accessible property. I know he had that in the planning phases at one point. But then also how he thought about branding and marketing and cutting to the chase. It was like, it turned out I learned a ton from this guy who had a couple properties at that point. And it also ended up being a friendship. And so once again, I was leaving a friendship on the table as well as a learning opportunity on the table. And it's closely related to that, not befriending competition, except these aren't competition. These are the people that we might be tempted to think we're better than, and we aren't.
100%. I used to facilitate a bunch of masterminds. We had about a dozen masterminds here at Vintory, and then we've turned it over to Tristan Webb. But when I'd facilitate these, we had a lot of like small startups, 1, 2, 3 properties. And I'm telling you, some of the best ideas I've ever heard were from these companies. I'll give you a perfect example. Jed Stevens, he's been with us since he had about 8 properties. I'm telling you what, that guy runs the most dialed in machine I've ever seen in my life. And he had 8 properties because he's a former engineer and he ran it like an engineer. But don't discredit just because they only have a handful of properties. Don't go around asking how many properties you have. And if they have under 100 or whatever, that you dismiss them, you will learn just as much, if not more, from some of these smaller property managers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've peeked under the hood, Brooke, at some pretty poorly run companies that have 200 listings. And yes. I've also peeked under the hood at companies that have 5 listings that are crushing it with a very happy guest, phenomenal returns and stuff like that. That's a good call out, David, to Oster. He figured out a lot of things early on. Purpose built, he nailed that with like his bedroom designs and things like that. Oh, if you're going on a golf trip with your buddies, you don't want to get stuffed in some room with 2 twin beds. You want the same room as everybody else. He figured that out. And he figured out this like constrained land supply thing that's very popular for people to talk about now. Oh, don't go build in an overcrowded market. He went and was like, oh, I'm acquiring this land on this golf course that literally there's only 3 lots here and I own 2 of them, right? Like he figured that out a decade before everybody's talking about it today. So yeah, he definitely deserves a bit of a shout out because he's done some really clever things. I like that. That's a good call out. Awesome. Moving along then into technology, which I know you have a lot of experience and knowledge of too. So this will be a fun one. I focused on developing the wrong technology. Instead of developing technology to save money, I should have stayed laser focused on building technology that was going to provide us a unique advantage over everything else in the market. For most technology needs, the industry already solved the problem. You ended up spreading the team too thin. And the result was products that actually weren't really that much better than the ones that were out there. So how do you sort through that decision-making process today? How do you evaluate like off-the-shelf software as opposed to stuff that you can build and make better? And how do you, you know what the right approach is based on that information?
Yeah. So if I'm a property manager and I have funds to invest in building my own technology, I would think about it focused on this idea of a moat around your business that's going to protect you from the competition rather than I can save 7%. Here's why. There's a very important thing to understand. Technology always takes longer to build than you think it will. It always costs more to build than you think it will. And it always costs more to maintain and has more bugs than you think it will. And so once you realize all that, when you're looking at this thing, and let's say you're going to try to do something like build an owner scheduling app, owner scheduling app. But Calendly over here has this great scheduling app already built. This is an extreme example. But let's say you go and you think you're going to be able to build that once for $2,500, and then you can do a few little things maybe better than Calendly. In reality, what's going to end up happening is it's going to end up costing you $10,000 instead of $2,500, and then another $1,000 to maintain. You won't save any money with it. You're going to have bugs. You're going to miss owners. And then you're going to be very distracted and focused on the wrong thing. That would be a horrible move. And so what you want to do is instead focus on something that's going to give you a competitive advantage, a moat around your company, something that's going to differentiate you from others if you do have this budget to invest in technology. And it's not going to be buying a product or building a product from scratch, like a PMS or a pricing tool or a Calendly or the next front app. That would be a foolish endeavor to undertake. Rather, this may be something around operations where you have a specific need that maybe there's not something on the market that takes care of it, or something around marketing and you realize you could do something with fantastic owner marketing that nobody else is doing through a piece of technology. So there's some things like that would make sense, especially for a smaller property manager all the way up to maybe 500 units. And then once you get about 500 units, then you can start to explore building other things at a cost-saving basis or some of those other things. But you just need a big tech team to start doing that.
It's also the opportunity cost. What is the opportunity cost of that time? All that time you spent trying to build this little widget or this little app, you could have spent getting new homeowners or getting new guests. It's also, I imagine, a little bit like what you're talking about before with the Dunning-Kruger effect. You know, you think about all, you think it could be, how hard can this be? And then the more you actually get into it, you realize just how little you do know about it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like, David, you nailed the project triangle very well there, where it's like speed. What is it? Speed, cost, quality, pick 2 or something like that. And it always costs more than you think. It's never quite as good as the options and always takes longer. It's just a bad combination to be in for sure.
Yeah. It's like a geometric revenue reduction triangle.
It's other than those 3 problems, everything's great about building your own tools and technology. Yeah. I will say I had a client one time who had built some, I think they almost built like an add-on to their PMS. It wasn't the PMS, but it was some kind of add on top of it. And the developer just ghosted them, basically hired through a freelance site like Upwork or something like that. Just went away. Yeah. So the code was still there in the server, but no one could understand it. It was like all written in a way, and they just ended up having to rebuild it from scratch. That was a good example too of like, you got to trust the team that's building it too, if it's someone internally. Whereas the company, like, they have an incentive to keep that software up and running for all their customers. So that was a fun one for them to go back, go through that painful process as well.
Yeah, I was talking to a guy here in Nashville, and he was going to build a PMS from scratch. One guy. And he was talking about how much money there was in this market and stuff, and didn't know that I was employed by Guestia, and I'm just like talking with him. And then I just asked what I felt was a valid question. How do you plan to compete with companies that have raised hundreds of millions of dollars and have teams of hundreds of engineers or equity-backed companies or all these things? Because the market has very high demands. They aren't going to wait on you to build this product. This product already exists, and they aren't going to be patient with you if the features aren't perfect today. And it was a little bit of a light bulb moment, I think, for him. But at the end of the conversation, he was still planning on building it. And he thought there'd be a segment for it in the less professionalized arena. I guess that's called Guesty for Hosts and Owner Res and a bunch of other players in that space, too. But that's what he was going to go after. So good luck to him.
Good luck. Maybe he'll surprise us. You never know.
You never know.
Yeah. Awesome. We'll head on over to number three here. Number three, I neglected my own health and happiness by not putting boundaries in place. I had a mantra of, I know you mentioned this earlier as well, David, but treat each owner like the only owner and live by it. But that came at personal cost. Gave up exercise, gave up date nights, would let owners interrupt critical time with family, wife, kids, etc. At our company, you wanted to deliver exceptional owner service. However, you burned out and that led to the decision perhaps to sell, or that contributed to the decision to sell the property management side of the business. So what was the process you went through here? And what do you think you can tell someone who needs to put up those boundaries or limits, just so you can still deliver great service, obviously, but you also keep yourself intact as well through that process?
Yeah, I think time blocking is a great tool that can be used here, where you block out time, and this is my time for me or my time for my family. And it's a set time each day. It's difficult when you're small. So I'm not trying to gloss over it and say it's a done deal. But if you have even one other employee that can take the hot phone or the owner phone, whatever it is, for a couple of hours, a few times a week, that will help prevent the burnout. And as you grow, process things out well to where you can take less and less of that time on the phone with an owner at night, that type of thing. And I think it's appropriate to set those boundaries even at the very beginning. If we believe in excellent customer service, we will do anything and everything for you and your property. Here's what that looks like to us. If there's a true emergency, you can call me anytime. If it's not a true emergency, if grandma's quilt is missing and you're checking in at 11:30 at night, I'm not really expecting to wake up and talk about it right then, because I'm not going to give you my best self at 11:30 at night. I'd rather talk to you about the next morning and have a great attitude with you and do this right and fix the problem, whatever it might be. If it's a smaller problem, when you're checking in, cleaning issue, we absolutely want to hear every detail about it. We want to have the right stakeholders there, but let's not do that call at 1 a.m. That's not fair to either of us. And so we would start to have those conversations. And it's not to say that every single owner is going to follow that guidance. Of course, we know that's not true. But even having those conversations and setting those boundaries from a sales perspective, right at the beginning of these conversations of what a relationship looks like, helped further on. The further along we came, the less of those late night calls over silly things when I'm in the middle of tucking my child in, who was young at that time. You know, those, and then you end up feeling like torn apart too. Like you did a bad job with your kid that night. You did a bad job with the owner that night. Your business is suffering. Your sleep is suffering. I would remember, I'd just get angry in the middle of the night if somebody would call me, and I wouldn't be able to go back to sleep because I was so just pissed off that somebody had woken me up over something stupid at 1:30 in the morning. And so then it wasn't even just the 10 minutes. It was a few hours sometimes, because like I'd just be like trying to problem solve the issue or whatever it was. But those boundaries can actually help you deliver the customer service excellence instead of take away from it if you do it strategically.
Man, I remember the days of care. We physically had a cell phone that was just for after hours. This was pre being able to forward calls. I hated when I had to do after hours calls. There's nothing worse than having to deliver, and I've done it, delivering linens in the middle of the night and all those things. But yeah, this was actually the bonus section of the book, Vicky's Journal Secrets, was creating this take care of yourself, don't take it personally, and don't forget to celebrate the wins. But I think there was probably close to a dozen people that talked about creating those proper boundaries. I think Jed Stevens talked about, he wished he started with better boundaries for personal life. He said the tools are available now, like after hours, overnight call answering services, which can allow you to disengage from work and engage with your personal family life. I wish I had done this sooner instead of living with the phone in my pocket for eight straight years. Mike Harrington said the same kind of thing. Having proper boundaries is difficult. It's easy to be too available as an owner manager. This is a tough one as it might ultimately be your reputation and business on the line. But if you really want to build a sustainable organization for the long haul, letting your team perform and work through these issues on their own is a must. And like I said, I could go on probably a dozen different times, all the people that talked about this.
Yeah. No, I think, as you said, Brooke, it was probably the most common thread that we've heard. Yeah. I think people can learn a lot from that for sure. Let's keep things going. I know in the interest of time, we got to get moving on the last two here. Number two, I wasn't consistent at excellent owner marketing. I wonder if Brooke will have something to add on this. Our company did a decent job at owner marketing, but consistency was an ongoing issue. The marketing was either too inconsistent or ordinary and didn't stand out. If you had to do it over again, you would have delivered more consistent, more innovative, and good owner marketing to keep the pipeline healthy and avoid the peaks and valleys on owner sales. Sign a few homes, quiet for a while, sign a few homes, and so on and so forth. So if only Venturi existed when you were running your company, but I don't think that was the case, David. So what was the process that you went through on owner marketing? What were some of the things you did well, maybe? And then if you went back and could be more consistent, what would you change to do differently?
We did a lot. What we failed at was consistency. And really, there were little things that were big things that we got wrong, like a phone number on postcards for 3 months in a row once and things like that. Mistakes that can easily be made. And then you're wondering why you haven't had any leads off of three postcard pushes when you normally get four or five. And then you look at the postcard and you're like, man, because we were using tracking numbers that we were self-servicing through Twilio. And you know, there's a lot that goes into things like that if you're wanting to track it well. But this idea of like excellent tracking and attribution actually caused us to have no leads for a few months. So that would be an example. Or just forgetting the postcard pushes. When we sent out our first postcard push, we signed like 25 properties. We didn't know what we were doing. And so then we're like, holy crap, we have all these properties coming in. And so then it was just like, we were chasing our tail for a few months and we should have capped the postcards going out, even if we weren't ready to take people, because then it would have created almost this like fear of missing out the next time when we were willing to take people. And so there were things around that, but By and large, the top mistake I see people make in this is the same mistake we made. They aren't consistent enough. It's like that old school car ad. It had to be there every Sunday in the paper because the transmission was going to go out sometime 2 years from now, not today. And if Bob's seen your ad every week for those 2 years, it doesn't matter if it's not in there when he opens it that day, because he's going to look at the ads that day. And so that consistency is the same with our owners. It's not a one-time push where we can fool ourselves into thinking they frame our postcard and hang it on the wall and they're going to call us when they need to. It's going in the trash can if it doesn't catch their attention. It's going in the trash can, over and over again. And then eventually they're going to actually read it, like what you have to say, and call you.
Yeah. David, you can't see it right now, but a small tear is rolling down my cheek right now. This is what I preach about all the time. We see it. Again, we've got more data on this than anyone. We've helped over 700 companies now. And every webinar I do, every presentation I do at Verma or Darm, it talks about the consistency principle. What is it? The marketing rule, the marketing principle 7. It's like you have to hit them at least 7 touch points. The companies that we see that are time and time again the most successful, they don't stop. They're consistent. Every single month they're sending something. They have to get it out there. It's the ones that have this like knee-jerk reaction and they go, and then they stop and they say it doesn't work. Those are the ones that aren't successful. We have all the data. The ones that are every single month, they're the ones that are most successful. I need you to record a little saying when we're done here, just to talk about this. I'm going to isolate it and put it as like an ad.
I'm pretty sure we did just record a little saying, if I'm not mistaken.
I want you to just isolate and you want you to say it. I don't want Conrad to say it.
Yeah, we need it as like a mantra where people wake up in the morning, Brooke, and they'll look in the mirror and they say, you are beautiful, you are worth it, and I must be consistent with my homeowner marketing. You know, so that's what we need right there.
Isolate that. A cold intro.
Yeah. All right. Amazing. So last one here that we had on the list, and this one came up a bit, David, so we can end on this one. I hired key people too slowly. When it came to hiring, we were quick to hire freelancers and independent contractors, but very slow at hiring full-time employees. Eventually, we did hire an absolute rock star, Miriam Ramsey. Her background in restaurants and hospitality made her a perfect fit, and she killed it from day one. Hiring her relieved a lot of bottlenecks, helped with owner satisfaction, helped with guest satisfaction. If I were, instead of waiting for all the math to pencil out perfectly, I should have just hired her earlier, and the numbers would sort themselves themselves out. So what was the process here? I'm sure Miriam was just one of many rock stars that you worked with, but what was the change that you made in hiring great people later on?
Yeah, the big thing, again, is like almost the interdependencies of all these failures and mistakes I made. And I don't know if that's come up a bunch of times before for you guys. But what I see is a lot of these mistakes overlap or input into each other. And had we hired Miriam sooner, for example, then it would have been easier to deliver exceptional customer service without sacrificing the mental health and the time with family, because then we would have been able to pass off the phone to her some of the nights. Yeah, so you can start to see how they all fit together. Maybe we would have even caught the telephone error because we wouldn't have been in such a hurry. And we probably got interrupted while we were generating the Twilio number and then designing the card because we were just wearing so many hats. So you start to look at all of these failures, and I think that's a pretty critical idea, because you can think of it like a chain, and we just need to break that chain. And sometimes there's one thing you can do to break this chain of events that's gonna hurt your company in meaningful ways. And I think that one piece, that one critical link, oftentimes is the key hire, because then you go back through all these other things that we mess up, and that one critical person, if you can get them in the right seat and you get them in at the right time, they can make up for a lot of your other potential shortcomings, really.
The key point, though, I think here is it's that key point. It's that rock star. It goes it's counterintuitive. And we heard a lot of people say hire slow, fire fast. You know, here what you're saying is hire fast, but hire the right person fast and bring them on sooner than later. We did hear that, I think, a couple times, Conrad, with doing these. But I think the critical piece there, though, is just having that right person. So how did you, I'm just curious, David, how did you know she was the right person?
You never know for sure when you're making the leap. You hope you are. We didn't use Culture Index or some of the things I know that you're probably going to reference or that you have referenced. But for us, it was really when we talked to her, we looked at her background, she was able to articulate what her strengths were and bullet point back them up. So it's one thing to say, I have a strong work ethic. It's another thing to say, I have a strong work ethic and I oversaw $39,000 worth of catering go out on Thanksgiving Day starting at 4 a.m. So, oh, wow, she does really work hard. And then the next bullet point and the next bullet point. And when I was interviewing her, she was so likable. And so I knew the guests were going to interact well with her and the owners, which they did. And then she would, every example she gave, she would back it up. And I think that's a thing to look for when you're interviewing somebody. And if any of you are ever interviewing, that's a great technique to use. The other thing that was a light bulb moment that I knew we'd got the right person. The main thing we needed was somebody that could communicate well with owners. And she hadn't been with us long. And she's from East Tennessee out there. Hadn't been like all over a tech or anything like that. We had an owner write an email in with some questions about pricing and some other things that were pretty complicated questions to answer. And so we're driving back to the office actually from another owner meeting. And she's like, oh, and I wrote this owner back for you. And I'm like, oh no. And she's, oh, I think you'll think I did just fine with it. Don't worry about it, David. Yeah, I mean, most of you have met Miriam now. She's pretty, pretty hilarious and awesome. And so she's, you're going to be just fine with it. Just wait. That's my best impersonation. I'm going to stop right now. And so I get back and I read it. And I'm like, I couldn't have written a better email myself. This is an excellent email. She addressed all of the owner issues, everything. And so I asked her, I was like, how in the world did you know all this? And she goes, oh, you've been copying me. And so I have a Google Doc going over here and I just copy and paste things under these different headings I made. And so that was a pricing question. So I went to the pricing one and I started grabbing some of that stuff and just copying it in. And then I hit send. It didn't take long. And at that point, I knew for sure we had the right person because I hadn't given her this process. She had created it and she had figured out how to answer questions that were beyond her pay grade or skill at that point using creativity. And that's what was going to be required out of that role. And right there from that day on, I knew we had the right person. And she was hire number one there, stayed with us till the end. And she's still with Steve Miley to this day.
That's right. And she didn't have ChatGPT then, too.
No, she was GPT. It was Miriam GPT. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. I know we're at time here, guys, but I think, Brooke, you have one more question for David to round us out here. And yeah, thanks again, David, for hopping on here. But we got one more for you on Brooke's end.
Yeah. David, as always, thank you for coming on. But yeah, I'm just curious, if you could go back in time and talk to your 25-year-old self and give some advice, what would it be?
That far in the future, huh? If I could go back in time and talk to my 25-year-old self, I think what I would say is you don't have to have everything figured out right now. What you think you're going to be doing for a living at 43, how old I am, is not what you're going to be doing. You don't have this near as figured out on your 10 and 20-year plan as you think you do. So you're going to need some North Stars to follow along the way. And if you have those, you're going to be all right. And I would have told myself one of those is going to be, you're going to be in the hospitality industry. And that's going to end up being where you head. And it's going to be easy to think about how some days it doesn't feel like you're making a difference. It just feels like you're doing something mundane. You would have never signed up for this thing, maybe in high school or college, that this is what you're doing. But you are making a difference. That there are people that work 30 weeks out of the year to have that 5 days with the family that they're taking to the Smoky Mountains. And those people have a chance for those 5 days to be a better dad, a better mom, to have that time together, to make up for long hours in the office, to have family bonding and create memories that are going to last the rest of their life. And while we're cogs in this machine, we're important. And that is the purpose, that to give people better lives and better times together and better family bonding. And it's so easy to, in the mundane of the daily, like what's my CAC or let's get a hairdryer over here or whatever that is, to lose focus of this. What we are doing is meaningful and drives value for each of these people.
Well said. What a great way to end.
Well, I wouldn't end just yet because I wanted to thank you for doing the book, Brooke. It was really good. And I would have told my 25-year-old self that you're going to get into the industry too soon because this rock star is going to come along and publish this book of all these secrets. And man, I think it's a pretty sweet playbook for somebody that's new to the industry, but also somebody that's been here for a while to have that. Because you think about the people that are in the book and that distill mistakes, that get vulnerable, that are willing to be humble enough to show, like, here's where I messed up. That's not common. And to get this many people doing that, it's exceptional reading. Thank you for including me in it alongside all of these other incredible people that were also featured in it. And thank you for doing it for the industry.
Of course. My pleasure. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks everybody for listening. If you made it this far, I'm sure you got a lot of value out of what David had to say, and you can learn a lot from him. I've learned a lot from him in my personal career, meeting him a long time ago. I've always picked up things and learned things from him. So we appreciate your time, David, and you hopping on and recording with us today, and we will see you on the next episode. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening.
And that wraps up another episode of the Vintory Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's deep dive into the world of vacation rentals with our guests. Their top mistakes and the lessons learned along the way are invaluable for anyone looking to grow in this exciting industry. Thank you for tuning in and being part of our community. If you found value in today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast. Your support means a lot to us and helps us bring more of these insightful stories and tips directly to you. And if you have a moment, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Leave us a review on our podcast app of your choice. Your feedback not only helps us improve, but also helps others in the vacation rental business find us. Lastly, if you know a friend or a colleague who'd benefit from these lessons shared today, don't hesitate to share this episode with them. Sharing knowledge is one of the best ways we can grow together in this industry. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll uncover more secrets to success in the world of vacation rentals.